Wednesday at Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, thousands of people here in Wisconsin are waiting on the state to work through a backlog of unemployment insurance claims. We'll find out about the effect that's having and look at what the state is trying to do to catch up. Now, imagine an alien species with an incredible ability. They have built-in chemical detectors in their bodies that can alert them to the presence of many of the invisible substances, even trace amounts of them, floating in the air around them. And their brains have the power to catalog those chemicals, learn from them, and use them to detect dangers and toxins and to sense food and even the presence of loved ones. The aliens is us, and the secret chemical detection power, it's our sense of smell. Our next guest explores the world of smells in his new book and wants to change the way you think about and experience your own sense of smell. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Out of all the senses, how do you rate smell as an important way that you experience the world? Have you ever wondered about why things smell the way they do and how we detect and interpret them? Maybe there's a particular smell, pleasant or otherwise, that you'd like to know more about. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Harold McGee writes about the science of food and cooking. He's the author of books including On Food and Cooking and Keys to Good Cooking. His latest book is called Nosedive, a field guide to the world's smells. Harold, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's great to be with you.
You're a food writer who's tackling the world of no smell, and no surprise, you say it was a meal that kind of got you started on this path. Tell us about that meal.
Well, my beat is food and cooking, and so I eat and drink a lot of things, and I'm generally not that surprised by anything. But I had a big surprise once when I was in England during grouse season. Grouse is a very English tradition. It's only available a couple of months out of the year. I'd never experienced it before. So I ordered it for lunch and took a bite and was so taken aback by the flavor that the people I was having lunch with thought I was having a heart attack. I was speechless. And that moment was so powerful that it got me to thinking about the sense of smell in particular, because it was that aspect of that bite of grouse that really got to me. It was really funky, kind of meaty to the nth degree, really, really powerful. And it made an impression and sent me on my nosedive through the world of smells.
Let's talk about what smell is, because light, we know it's light bouncing off, or seeing, we know it's light bouncing off of stuff. Hearing is sound waves. Touching and taste, we're actually in physical contact with a thing. But what are we perceiving when we perceive a smell?
Well, what we're perceiving are little bits of the world around us. It's the most direct sense, most direct contact we have with the world around us. So what happens is that little bits of materials in our environment, molecules, single molecules, escape from those materials, fly through the air up into our noses where there are receptors waiting to detect them. And then the receptors report to the brain, and that's how we know that there's something out there that smells.
And brains, over time, our brains develop this catalog of smells, and a lot of our understanding of what a smell is and what it means is based on our past, our smell biography, I guess, right?
Exactly. It's from birth, in fact, from before birth, we're developing a database of smells that we've come across that our noses have detected and that our brain has turned into a perception. And we draw on those databases to interpret what it is that we experience as we go through life.
And we can get better at understanding smells. You talk to people who do things like develop perfumes and otherwise train their noses to develop an appreciation of the subtle odors out there. How can we learn how to smell better?
Well, the best way to learn how to smell better is just to pay attention to smells. That's really all it takes. And that's all that training as a perfumer or a flavorist really amounts to. It's very intensive and organized in their case, but simply paying attention as you walk down the street or you're cooking dinner, paying attention to the little nuances that you notice and trying to place them, try to identify them. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not so easy, but the more you pay attention, the bigger your database grows and the more you can enjoy that smell when you come across it the next time.
One of the things that make it hard, I learned from your book, is that most of the things we think of as a particular smell are actually combos. They're assemblages of different elements of smell. How does that work?
Well, it turns out that the things in the physical world are complicated. They're not simple, one molecule things. And so everything that we smell is giving off many different molecules at a given moment. And smell is a little bit like hearing a chord in music. A chord is built up of individual notes, and smells in the world are built up of individual molecules, each of which has a particular smell. And then it's the combination of those individual notes that give us the overall chord, the smell of the object itself.
Talking to Harold McGee about his new book, Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. Again, I learned from your book, Harold, I've always assumed that dogs are better at smelling things than us humans. And I always hear, they have so many more smell receptors, therefore they're better at smelling. You write, not necessarily so. Why not?
That's right. It turns out that we do have fewer smell receptors than many mammals. But the number of receptors we have really doesn't determine how good we are at smelling, because even with the paltry 400 or so smell receptors that we have compared to several times that in some other animals, we can still detect theoretically thousands upon thousands upon thousands of different molecules. So it's really a matter of training and making smell an important part of your life. For the dog, it's an important part of its life from the moment it's born. And it's down there on the ground and it's smelling all kinds of things. We're up in the air. It's not as important to us in everyday life. But if we work at it, we can get to be as good or maybe better. It would be, I think, difficult to train a dog to detect the differences in, wines or beers or cheeses that connoisseurs of those things enjoy.
I think of something like water, just plain water, as not having a smell. Is it more accurate to say we don't have the receptors that can detect those water molecules?
That's exactly it. There are lots of molecules in the air that we do not detect as smells because we do not have receptors. And that makes a lot of sense because they're kind of there all the time and they don't really have any significance. Water is one, oxygen is another, nitrogen, which is 70-odd% of the air around us. We don't have a receptor for nitrogen either because we'd be smelling it all the time and that would be distracting.
You break down your field guide to smells by kind of categories, how long they've been around and what produces them. There are smells, or at least things that we could smell if we could get there in the middle of what we look at as empty space out in the universe. Why?
Well, yeah, so I started out life thinking I was going to be an astronomer. And so when I started thinking about smells and molecules coming off of things in the world, I began to wonder when it would have been if there was a human with an avatar of us that could smell from the Big Bang on, when would we begin to detect things that we would recognize from here on Earth? And it turns out that it's very, very early, before there are even any planets necessarily, because smells are made up of molecules. Molecules are made up of elements. And certain elements, particularly carbon and oxygen and hydrogen, are very, very good at playing with each other. And so out in space, just kind of floating around, they find each other and form molecules that we would recognize here on Earth. Things like acetic acid, which is the smell of vinegar, or even some fruity molecules, things that fruits use to indicate that they're ripe, are out there smelling fruity for no one in particular.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. 40 years ago, I used to lead hikes at Patterson State Park up here in near Superior. And when I brought people on the trail, I would say, don't only look at the colors, of course, and the shapes and the textures of things and feel the wind blow and all that. But I used to tell people to smell the experience of hiking, because you had mud, you had cedar, you had evergreen, you had moss that you could smell when you put your nose up near a tree. And the freshness of the forest really did clean. And when I told people about that sense of our experience, people really, their eyes just got bigger, because it was eye-opening for them to realize that it's not just something you see, but it's something you smell as you walk through a forest.
Jeff, thank you so much for that. I love that, and I definitely appreciate the smellscapes of nature. You spend a lot of time, Harold, in the book on plants and moss and soil. Talk about some of the smellscape that Jeff just described there.
Well, yeah, no, that's a wonderful experience and a great way to begin reflecting on and getting to know smells better, because you're smelling all different sorts of things on a walk like that. The pine needles and the fir needles and things like that, those smells, which we find so fresh and pleasing and so on, are actually defensive chemical weapons for the trees, to protect them from attack by insects and molds and bacteria, things like that. The world is basically about living things trying to get enough energy to perpetuate themselves. And plants, trees, weeds aren't able to move, aren't able to run away from predators, so they find ways to defend themselves standing stock still. And a lot of the smells that we enjoy from plants in particular are those defensive chemical weapons. We don't experience them as dangerous because, of course, we're not trying to eat a fistful of pine needles. If we did, we'd realize that they're not necessarily so nice in high doses.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We're talking to Harold McGee about his book, Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. He frequently writes about the science of food and cooking. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are there smells that have a particularly strong effect on you, for good or ill? Wonder what might be the molecules that make it up? Is there a smell that other people think of as bad that you actually kind of like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Harold McGee about his newest book, Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your favorite maybe memory of smells or a question about a particular smell that you've encountered in your life. The number is 800-642-1234. Okay, Harold, there's a weird theme in smells where bad things, maybe a cat urine, share smells with good things like coffee or wine, or feet, bad stinky feet smells share a smell profile with cheese, delicious cheese. What's going on there?
Well, it's a reflection of the fact that all these things are emitting mixtures of volatile molecules, molecules that are small enough to fly into the air, and so we can smell them. And it turns out that there's a lot of overlap among what we would think of otherwise as very different things. So in the case, for example, of feet and stinky cheese, well, the reason feet that have been kind of confined for too long in leather or some other container and have gotten sweaty, The reason they stink is that bacteria are growing on the surface of our feet all the time, and they have a real field day under conditions like that when there's a lot of moisture around. And so they break down our skin proteins and produce very particular molecules that we recognize right away. And it turns out that cheese is not all that different a situation. You've got high protein material from an animal, this time not skin, but milk. And that milk has been concentrated into a block of cheese. And then the surface of the cheese, in the case of washed rind cheeses, which are the really stinky ones, the surface of the cheese is actually washed intentionally with a brine that is very close to the composition of human sweat. So you end up with the same kind of thing, bacteria breaking down proteins and making some of those same stinky molecules.
Let's bring on another caller now. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. Hi. I'm just wondering if he knows what it is about the air that makes us able to smell that it's going to snow.
To smell when it's going to snow. I have that with rain, and I think a lot of people do, Harold. I haven't encountered that with snow, though. Is that something you've seen?
It's something that I've experienced, but I have never found any information about how that might work. People do understand why it is that the smell of rain is so distinctive, and that has to do with the fact that rain actually makes the volatile molecules that provide smells, makes them more volatile, makes them leave the dust particles and the other things in the air that are carrying them so that they're more available to our noses to be detected. With snow, I'm hard pressed to come up with an explanation for why that is, but I know exactly what the caller means.
Let's bring on another caller now. Thanks, Susie. Tina is with us in Madison. Tina, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Tina?
Well, thanks for taking my call. 20 years ago, I went through cancer and had chemo and radiation, and I lost both sense of smell and taste. I've never gotten them back, and I miss that sense of smell. How, or is there any way or anything to do for that?
Interesting, Tina. So sorry to hear that. And the sense of smell, I know, influences the sense of taste. Harold, is this something you came across in your book, people losing their sense of smell for one reason or another?
Yes, I've experienced temporary sense loss of smell occasionally, just from, you know, bad sinus infections, but it's always come back. It is well recognized that certain chemotherapy treatments do damage the senses of taste and smell, and that's because the cells that produce the detectors for taste and smell are very sensitive to those chemicals and can be damaged by them. And as far as I know, to date, there hasn't really been a treatment to bring those senses back. Just a really difficult thing. It's hard to keep yourself well nourished when the pleasure of eating is compromised that way.
Tina, sorry, we don't have better news for you. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Carl joins us next in Eau Claire. Carl, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I guess my curiosity kind of goes a little bit along the lines of Tina's question, in that the more we smell, the more we smell. Or said differently, when we use our sense of smell and develop it, does it tend to get better? And or are we at a disadvantage if we didn't do that when we were younger?
Interesting. So the more we practice our sense of smell, Carl wonders, does it get better?
Yes, it does. That's the good news. And it doesn't really matter how much you've used it during your life up to the point that you decide to use it, because it turns out that the nose can actually notice without our realizing it when it's being exposed to smells that it hasn't seen before. And it can actually amp up its ability to detect those smells and let us know about them, when the nose is repeatedly exposed to those smells. So, yeah, just taking advantage of your spice cabinet or going for a walk or, you know, going to the market and seeing a fruit or a vegetable that you've never seen before, giving it a whiff, all those things will help develop the sense of smell.
Thanks for the call. We'll go now to Natalie with us in Port Washington. Natalie, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, I guess my most favorite smell is the smell of being outside and smelling cow manure from a farm. And every time I'm with people, they're like, oh, we hate that smell. And someone asked me the other day why I love that smell and asked me, maybe did I grow up on a farm? Is that why I love it? And I didn't. So I really don't have an idea of why. My only thought is growing up, that was my dad, one of my dad's favorite smells. So I don't know if it's because I have an association with him in that, but that is my favorite smell for some reason.
Well, you're in the right state, Natalie. We have a lot of dairy air, as we say. Harold, why do some people appreciate bad smells that others do not?
I hadn't heard that term dairy air before. That I love that. I'm going to remember that. So when it comes to preference, when it comes to what it is that people like and don't like, that's a totally individual thing. There really are no kind of universal rules that this particular kind of smell is repellent and this particular kind of smell is attractive. It depends entirely, as we were saying before, on the database of experiences that you have inside your head and what the significance of those smells has been in your past. So I think it probably is an association with your father and with, you know, all the good feelings that that association would have.
Gail, thanks so much for calling in at 800-642-1234. We're talking about our sense of smell and about the molecules that create the aromas and odors that we encounter every day. Harold McGee is going to stay with us until after the news. He writes about the science usually of food and cooking. His latest book is called Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. Still time for you to join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or your own smell experiences. 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Is there a question you have, a curiosity you have about a smell, why one thing smells like another, a smell that you like, as our last caller mentioned, that everyone else does not like? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Coming up, we'll check out the human armpit and find out why we have this one part of our body that creates such smells. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the world of smells that surround us and how those scents are produced and detected by us. Harold McGee stays with us. He writes about the science of food and cooking, and his latest book is called Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. Harold, before we go back to our callers, I'm going to ask you a question that it turns out humans have been asking since ancient times. What's the deal with our armpits?
Well, it turns out to be a really complicated and really interesting evolutionary story. The short version would be that the smells that emanate from our armpits are actually intentional. They're not just a sign of bad hygiene. Our body actually generates molecules that by themselves have no smell whatsoever, but when they're secreted by the glands in our armpits, and made available to bacteria that hang out there, the bacteria are able to take those smellless molecules and liberate a piece of those molecules that does smell. And that's what makes human body odor. So we have this kind of agreement with the microbes that live with us that we want them to let other people know that we're around. And that's exactly what happens when back in the old days, you would raise your arm in greeting or in fierceness to defend yourself. You would let go a puff of yourself that that would make an impression on the other person.
And we've been fighting this smell for a long time. Today, was it a kind of a guide for love in ancient Greece that you quoted from that said basically, dude, don't smell like a goat or something like that?
Exactly. And they knew back then to use something called alum, which is still used in antiperspirants, which closes up the pores and prevents the secretion of those smelly molecules.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Verona. Gail, hello.
Hello. Thank you for the topic. What a fun topic. I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about memory and smell. I've had experiences that usually revolves around my grandmother's home, and that smell only shows up in my dreams. And I always want to go back there. But I don't smell it when I'm awake. It only shows up in my dream. Can you talk a little bit about that? Thanks.
Wow, Gail, thanks for sharing that. Smells and our memories, Harold.
Yes, it turns out that smell is a very primitive sense, by which I mean that it's been important to living things almost since living things existed on the planet, just single cells, because it's important to know what's around us. And so it turns out that our sense of smell is wired to a very ancient part of our brain that's also where we find the seat of our emotions, and especially strong feelings of either attachment and comfort or danger and concern. And so what you're experiencing there is the connection that your brain must have made very early on between the comfort of your grandmother's presence and the particular smells that she surrounded herself with.
Fantastic. Thanks for sharing that with us. We're talking to Harold McGee about his new book, Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells. Back to your calls now. Denise is with us in Milwaukee. Denise, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what do you want to tell us about, Denise?
Puppy breath. I love the smell of puppy breath. I can't get enough of it.
And I assume you like puppies in general, not just the breath?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And in fact, we just got a new puppy.
Oh, fantastic, Denise. What kind of puppy before I let you go?
It's a Staffordshire Terrier.
All right. Well, enjoy, Denise. Thanks a lot. What about animal breath, Harold, and the positive associations we might have with it?
Well, a young animal, like a baby, like a human baby, is, you know, it's newborn life. And so you're getting the smells of that new metabolism, that fresh metabolism on the planet. Without the accrual of the not-so-nice smells that we associate with the breath of ourselves, for example, the smells that we're getting when we're wearing masks these days much more than we used to. So it's the smells of that young animal and actually the microbes living in its mouth, because there are many and they contribute to that as well. But it's there's nothing like it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Enjoy the new puppy, Denise. Pete joins us next in Wausau. Pete, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering about a smell, musk, in my basement. And I really like the smell, but no one else in my family does. And I'm wondering why.
Interesting, Pete. Do they try to make you clean the basement to get rid of the smell?
Nope.
Pete, thanks a lot for calling in. Yeah, that musty basement smell. I'm imagining that's quite a cocktail of scents, Harold.
Yes, it is. And I had a bedroom in a basement in a house myself back in the day. And I know exactly what Pete is saying. And it's, again, something that you can get used to. And it means that, you know, it's your home, it's familiar and that kind of thing. But musty smells in basements are, generally speaking, produced by mold. And molds grow on organic things. There doesn't have to be much of it. Even just dust is enough to support the growth of mold. And mold, generally speaking, is not such a great thing to have around us, at least when we're not controlling it. So I think that's why most people find mustiness a little bit upsetting and a nudge to do some cleaning.
You know, Pete, I was going to argue with you there at first, but then it hit me, Harold, you know, a musty used bookstore. I've got a lot of positive associations there. There are some cases where I could forgive that smell and maybe even enjoy that smell when I might not enjoy it somewhere else.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And if you know that it's coming from books, that's one thing. If it's just kind of emanating from the basement as a whole, you know, the nooks and crannies and corners and so on, that's a different experience.
Pete, thanks for that call. We'll go to Vincent now with us in Madison. Vincent, hi.
Yes, hi. About 55 years ago, I was doing some research on isolating the sex pheromone of female cockroaches. And I estimated that about 50 molecules of the sex pheromone could be perceived by a male cockroach.
Wow.
And when we had a cage of male cockroaches, I would stick a stirring rod into this weak solution of the female sex attractant and hold it in the air, and about 30 feet away, those male cockroaches would immediately go into a frenzy.
Interesting. Vincent, thanks for that call. Harold, you spend a lot of time. Insects do a lot of interesting work with their smells.
That's right. They communicate with each other, and they ward off creatures like us to make us not want to get involved with them. I can remember as a kid wandering around in vacant lots and finding grasshoppers and ladybugs and, you know, picking them up and looking at them and then smelling what they were leaving on my hands, and I was much less interested. So they, too, are very good at chemical warfare via smells.
In our last minute or so, Harold, this has been, a 10-year journey for you, cataloging these smells, finding unusual smells around the world. Do you feel like you have a much more discerning sense of smell now than when you started off?
Oh, I definitely do. Once I decided that this was my subject and then spent 10 years at it, you know, that's a lot of time to absorb smells and to think about them and to learn about them. And so I went off in search of things that I never would have gone to smell otherwise. A lot of them, you know, unusual things like incense and perfumes. I really didn't have any interest in perfumes until I started writing this book, but they turn out to be made up of these just amazing natural materials from all different corners of the living world. And so, for me, it was just a wonderful expedition, and it hasn't stopped. I'm going to keep going.
Harold, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
For me too, Rob. Thank you.
Harold McGee writes about the science of food and cooking. His latest book is Nosedive, a field guide to the world's smells. He is with us to explain the science of our sense of smell and to share the wonder of all the scents, aromas, stenches, and more that surround us. Coming up, thousands of Wisconsinites are still waiting for the state to process unemployment insurance claims. We'll find out about the impact that's having on people as a federal program providing extra weeks of benefits is being shut down in the state. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on the morning show, we might think of farming as a simple way of life, but in many ways, it's a high-technology field of work. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the ways the latest technological advances are shaping the world of agriculture. That's tomorrow at 6 on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin's unemployment rate hit a record high of 13.6% this April after the COVID-19 outbreak. Thousands of people filed for unemployment insurance with the state's Department of Workforce Development, which is still working through a backlog of more than 74,000 claims. Unemployment has since dropped before 5%, and last week a federal program providing weeks of extra benefits was shut down in Wisconsin. For those still looking for work, it means their benefits may run out much earlier than they'd thought. Rachel Vasquez is here to explain. She's a reporter for WPR News. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Rob.
Well, tell us a little bit about this extended benefits program.
Sure. So Extended Benefits is an unemployment insurance program that gave unemployment insurance recipients an extra 13 weeks of unemployment coverage. So I think probably the best way to think about it is kind of like a triple backup system. So a lot of people who lost their jobs throughout the pandemic found themselves on regular unemployment insurance. Those benefits maxed out at 26 weeks. If you were someone who lost your job and you got to the end of that 26 weeks and needed more unemployment insurance, you could go through a separate, an additional unemployment program created under the Federal CARES Act. And then if you ran out of unemployment insurance benefits under that program, then you could draw on potentially these extra 13 weeks of benefits under the Extended Benefits program.
But as I understand it, Rachel, there was a cutoff for states if their economy improved enough, if unemployment went low enough. What happens there at that threshold?
Yeah, that's right. So the Extended Benefits program is a little bit different than other unemployment insurance programs in that it uses these automatic triggers to turn the program on and off in states, depending on different metrics about the states of the health of a state's economy. So what triggered the benefits off a couple weeks ago in Wisconsin was something called the insured unemployment rate. That measures the share of people receiving unemployment insurance assistance the share of people receiving unemployment insurance assistance in the labor force in Wisconsin. That number dropped to less than 5%, which is the threshold needed to continue the program, so that program turned off.
So that's, in a way, a good news situation in that we went under that, our unemployment went down under that threshold. But for someone who's long-term unemployed, say because their restaurant closed or wherever they work closed because of COVID, that could be really bad news for them, right?
Right. Well, it means that for a lot of people receiving unemployment insurance, they've lost that as an option to extend their unemployment insurance coverage. But the other thing that I heard when I talked to experts about the unemployment insurance system is that it's not that that drop in the insured unemployment rate doesn't necessarily reflect the full scope of people on unemployment insurance assistance. A woman I talked to at Brookings told me that that number actually excludes all of the people on these new unemployment insurance programs created under the Federal CARES Act stimulus package. So there's a bunch of new programs that thousands of people are drawing on in Wisconsin, and those people weren't factored into the metric that actually turned the benefits off. So it's kind of artificially lower than the true extent of unemployment insurance assistance and need in Wisconsin.
So if someone had been looking at that saying, okay, if I don't get a job by the time those other benefits run out, I've got this backstop of 13 weeks, that is just shut off in Wisconsin now, right?
It's shut off for at least 13 weeks. Like I said, there's automatic triggers that turn the benefits on and off. But now that it's off, the program is off for at least 13 weeks in Wisconsin. And those metrics will continue to change. And if they tick back up, there's a chance that the benefits could turn back on. I think one important thing for people to know, though, is that DWD says there's absolutely no deadline to apply for the benefits. So they actually haven't started paying out any of the benefits under Extended Benefits yet because they haven't finished setting up the program. They say that that will be done, that process will be done in December next month. And when that happens, if you were eligible for Extended Benefits early on back in May when the program turned on, you can still apply for those benefits anytime and get the benefits that you were eligible for.
And Rachel, before we let you go, what are you watching for now with this extended unemployment benefit story?
I think the biggest thing that I'm watching for is if the program does turn on over the next few months. In addition to that, though, I know that there are some reforms. There are a lot of policy experts who are calling for reforms specifically to this extended benefits program. It's unclear if those reforms have a serious chance of passing in Congress. But there are people who are talking about it, and there are a lot of people in Wisconsin who would love to have these extra benefits and need these extra benefits. So I would be very interested to see if any of that comes to pass.
Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Rachel Vasquez is a reporter for WPR News. She talked with us about extra weeks of unemployment benefit extensions being shut down in Wisconsin after a drop in the unemployment rate. The state's Department of Workforce Development is still processing thousands of unemployment claims, and some people have been waiting, in some cases for months, to see benefits after losing their jobs. It's led to a feeling of hopelessness for some in Wisconsin, something our next guest heard echoed by lawmakers and mental health workers. Laura Schulte joins us now. She's a state government and state agencies reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Can you give us a sense, first of all, Laura, of the size and persistence of this backlog?
Yeah, so the last numbers that were released were, as of last Tuesday, over 74,000 people are waiting in that backlog for their cases to be adjudicated, and that adds up to over 554,000 weekly claims that adjudicators are working through.
And that would include a range of people who some might have applied last month, I imagine, but some people might go all the way back to the beginning of the pandemic, right?
Yes.
And you talked to some people in this situation who have been waiting for their application to be resolved, in some cases for months. What kind of things did you hear about their experiences?
People are really frustrated and they feel let down by the unemployment system, which they pay into with their state taxes. But it's also leading to feelings of hopelessness. People are missing bills. They can't pay their cell phone bill, their mortgage, their rent. They can't afford to put food on the table. This is affecting a lot of people with families, with children. In some cases, I've spoken to people who have waited for 6 or 7 months for benefits with no income, and it's leading them to have thoughts of suicide. And that's something that legislators are hearing from their constituents, too. It's a very difficult topic for them to deal with.
And we heard at the outset there was this really unprecedented wave of unemployment filings early on. It overwhelmed the system. What are we seeing now when it comes to efforts to still try to catch up with that?
So to try and eliminate the backlog, the state of Wisconsin has entered a partnership with Google Cloud. It's a $1.1 million program, which is kind of adding more technology to the mix. Wisconsin's unemployment system is very old, and people filing for unemployment are still having to do things like fax in their tax forms to get through the adjudication process. So this Google partnership aims to kind of speed up those processes by using technology, so allowing people to email those photos or submit them online, as well as using technology to sort through claims to weed out claims that look fraudulent. And that partnership runs through December 18th.
And now getting back to the mental health side of things, some people at workforce development and in legislators' offices and elsewhere, they're actually seeking out advice for what to do when it sounds like the people calling them about unemployment claims are having mental health potential emergencies. What kind of things are being suggested to them?
So legislators are actually being encouraged to contact the Capitol Police, who can get into contact with the police or sheriff's department in that municipality, connect those people to resources for help. And mental health experts in Wisconsin are saying telling people to check in on their family members, their friends, listen to their struggles and, validate that their feelings, that they're not alone in those feelings, to point to them towards resources that can be helped, whether it be therapy or other resources in the community, like going to a food bank to help put food on the table if that's what's necessary.
In our last few moments, Laura, what are you watching for next in this story?
I am keeping a close eye on the numbers of people waiting in adjudication. We're looking to see if these automations with using the Google technology is really helping getting that backlog done. I'm really hoping to see that backlog decrease significantly over the next couple of weeks before that program ends.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Laura Schulte is a state government and state agencies reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talked with us about the ongoing backlog of unemployment insurance claims at the state's Department of Workforce Development and the impact it's having on people still waiting for those benefits. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there are a lot of legal disputes over COVID-related safety measures, but this isn't the first time we've been here. An author tells us about disease and American law from smallpox to the modern day. Wisconsin's own Richard Davidson joins the show with lots of practical advice to help us manage stress and anxiety in uncertain times, including lessons from masters of mindfulness around the world. And a food writer joins us for a look at great comfort foods in a difficult year and healthy ways to cook and eat while relieving stress. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Sometimes courts and legal systems around the world rule on some of the weightiest issues facing society, matters of life and death, basic constitutional questions, and other heavy legal topics. And sometimes they have to venture into unfamiliar territory to answer questions like, what is music? German courts tackled that question this month and ruled that techno music does, in fact, count as music. Why? As reported by NPR, as part of COVID relief efforts, Germany gave a tax break to concert halls, defined in part as places that have live musical performances. But up till now, dance clubs that featured live DJ performances were not included in the tax break. Well, now hold on, the German techno community said in a court challenge, if a live DJ is sequencing and mixing music and presumably dropping the occasional bass, isn't that a kind of live musical performance? The German courts agreed, saying DJs were performing, quote, their own new pieces of music using instruments in the broader sense. So nightclubs get the tax break, and at a broader level, techno fans and DJs can celebrate the legal recognition. Today, ich bin ein DJ. Okay, not really, but we'll go out with some music played by our own DJ, Sarah Dachtel. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.